This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 6th of August 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the 43rd edition of Culture here on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bound. Today we've put all our art, music and media Scrabble tiles in our black velvet sack and shaken them up to provide you with a show whose parts are linked by the fact that, really, they have no link at all. So what do we find? Things, ladies and gentlemen, like this. We'll speak to the two photographers given Access All Areas passes to the training camp of those formidable point-perfect Chinese gymnasts in Beijing and who've put the results in a marvellous book.
The training process is something that's interested us. Everything before the 10 seconds of glory. What kind of person does this? What the training does to them? What does it take to do the impossible day after day as you try and achieve your dreams?
We'll head to Phnom Penh to see what happens when Cambodia's best gallery that isn't quite a gallery closes by turning from one hotel into another.
Of course, a lot of people have expressed certain concerns that going from a more individualistic hotel to a big chain, whether we'll be able to maintain that sort of atmosphere.
And I'll talk to the eminence grise of the art world, Michael Pepiat, about how to interview artists.
The best stuff came from when, you know, you turned the recorder off and you started drinking and then went out on the town with them. That's where the best stuff came.
Also on the art front, we'll hear from installation artist Anthony McCool's first solo show in Berlin. And in music, we'll have a live Midori House session from Copenhagen's wonderful Choir of Young Believers. And we'll mark MTV's 25 years in Europe by talking with the world's only professor of MTV. A packed show? We think so. Turn up the volume, put on your favourite hat. Stay tuned to Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. First up, a little music from that live session by Copenhagen's Choir of Young Believers, a band which is really the chamber pop imaginings of Yannis Noya Makrigiannis. This, from the latest record, Rheingold, is Nie Nummer Et.
Rather be
That was Choir of Young Believers with Ni Nummer Et. More from them later on in the show. So the Olympics are still in full swing here in London, but while we saturated you last week with our tour of the world sports commentators, we'll be a little easier on you this week with just one Olympic tale. For the first time, Beijing has opened the doors to its elite gymnast training facility for a photography book by famed duo Jonathan Anderson and Edward Lowe. In fact, the boys for this book have just won gold here in London. Endure, as it's called, is devoted to the quest for perfection in sport and is both candid and documentary. David Michon caught up with the two photographers to talk about their project.
We've been using sport as a muse in creating art projects for more than 15 years now. Obviously, during that time, we've seen an enormous change in how things have developed around the world, and the rise of China as a sporting power has been very, very obvious. We were invited by the elite Chinese gymnasts in Beijing to photograph in their training hall, and the training process is something that's interested us. Everything before the 10 seconds of glory, what kind of person does this, what the training does to them, what does it take to do the impossible day after day as you try and achieve your dreams. This book, Endure, is the result of our sojourns there. We were there for weeks at a time over a period of 2 years, and it was one of the most amazing experiences we've ever had.
And Edwin, maybe you can describe how this relationship started. Why were you two invited out of every photographer in China? Why did they choose two foreign photographers?
We've been actually wanting to photograph Chinese athletes for a long, long time, you know, since Beijing did the Olympics. It was by chance we went to China. We met the right people and the right connection. Just give an example. The final day after our first session with the Chinese gymnast, the coach came up to us and they said, "The reason I invite you here because I love your work. I know your body of works, you know your athlete books very well. You're our new friends now. Next time you come, you will be old friends. You can turn on the TV lights." So that's a very nice comment.
It probably doesn't sound like much, but by saying, you know, when you come back, you can turn on the TV lights yourself without asking, he's really saying, firstly, please come back.
It's a statement of approval.
Yeah. Yeah. And secondly, we can see that you understand what we're doing. Thank you for your resonance with that. And please continue the project. So, I mean, it was really a fantastic experience.
Maybe you could describe the aesthetic you were aiming for and what these photographs as a collection say about the sport.
Athletes are simultaneously the most ordinary people you'll ever meet and the most extraordinary people you'll ever meet. They achieve the impossible as a matter of routine on a daily basis. And yet, they're just like everyone else in terms of their daily lives. Gymnastics is particular within sport for the level of power, stamina, spatial awareness, flexibility. There really are very few sports like it. And again, beyond that, there are few sports where the dividing line between looking like a god and looking like a fool is so thin, because you either have done something wonderful or you land on your bum or you've got your arms flailing around in cartwheels, madly trying to retain your balance. So there's something very ultimate and slightly unforgiving about it as a sport, and you have to do it from a very, very young age to have even the remotest chance of success. And the risk of serious injury is present from the word go on a daily basis. And with the Chinese gymnasts, we simply saw a level of inspiration and training which we had not seen in any other institution in 15 years of working with this. There is nowhere in the West that we have ever seen that is remotely comparable. The first day we were there, we were almost in tears because it moved us so passionately. After 15 years in sport, you develop a mature relationship, but those first naive reactions aren't part of your life anymore. And suddenly we were wrenched back to these primal emotions, just so overwhelmed by the scale and the quality of what we saw.
Yeah, the first day we were invited, we were ushered into this big gymnasium and we went up to the auditorium. And this view over 500 kids and coaches. It was a very unusual day. It was a day I think they were having a review, you know, assessments of the provincial athletes that came in. And I've never seen anything like that, you know. Not just the scale, but, you know, emotional level, how these kids train. It was phenomenal. And the whole aspect of this book is literally the intimate journey of these Chinese gymnasts. We're thrilled and privileged to be able to get access to these kids.
I think what we're trying to show is not what it looks like when you're there, but what it feels like what they feel, what they experience, what they are going through on a daily basis, not just physically, because obviously the physical aspects are quite extraordinary within the book in terms of their training, but mentally, emotionally, spiritually, that's really the bit that interests us the most. What do they feel, and what do we feel when we watch them this close? What is it really like when you're there? Hopefully we've succeeded. The team leader, after we showed him some images, he said it was as though he'd never seen his own athletes properly before and that he was looking at them for the first time. He'd never seen the calluses and the chalk and the sweat and the bruises and the tears and the muscles and the strain until that moment, which for someone who's basically a Communist Party official is fairly unusual commentary, I think.
I mean, when you flip through this book, you do see some really extreme examples of training, people kind of being bent into really, you know, exceptional angles.
Hand on my heart, I did not see anything I thought was wrong.
It
was
just no, of course. You know, it totally seems within the context of what the objective is. But I wonder, you know, sport has, especially seemingly the Summer Olympics, has always been a really important thrust for countries like China, which really kind of use it to put themselves and give a really positive spin on the country internationally. This is something they're quite proud of. I imagine that for these gymnasts, some of whom are competing here at the Olympics, they are a source of national pride. Do you think that kind of made an impression on them?
Well, I think they are very aware of that. But I think more than that, success in sport in China changes the life of the competitor infinitely more than it would do for the West. In the West, it's mainly about quantity, how much money you make, how recognized you are. But in China, I think it can truly change the quality of a person and the person's family life and future prospects and education in a way that is simply inconceivable in the West. So I think what you say is true, but I think it's also the other way around. They're also aware, and they're collectively aware, that they're involved in something special and that success will be something very, very special for them individually and indeed for the institution that they train in.
And the book is available when and where?
The book is published right at the beginning of August. It's a very limited edition, a quite specially constructed book. I think it's limited to 750 copies, but it's available worldwide from the start of August.
That was Jonathan Anderson and Edwin Lowe talking to Monocle's David Michon, and their very limited edition book, Endure, is out now. Away from the Olympics and off to Cambodia now, where the artists have started to make an international impact in the last few years. The leading names have been increasingly popular in Southeast Asian galleries, as well as further afield in Europe, Japan and North America. But at home they got their start in a handful of cafe galleries, which hold exhibitions among the cakes and the coffee. One of the biggest and best known is the Arts Lounge at Siem Reap's Hotel de la Paix. But after seven highly successful years, it's closing as the hotel turns into a Hyatt. Our correspondent in Cambodia, Guy Delaunay, went to assess the impact of the demise of the Arts Lounge.
Another packed-out opening at the Arts Lounge. This space in one of Siem Reap's most stylish hotels has become one of the most important contemporary art galleries in Cambodia. The sunken area in the middle, ideal for sculptures and installations. The expanse of white walls around the edge, perfect for paintings. Most of the country's best-known artists have shown and sold here, and the venue has had a real impact on the rising international profile of Cambodian art.
I think it's played a huge role because the hotel is fortunate enough to have a very large PR machine. We've also had exhibitions that have been featured in Art Asia Pacific. Other journalists have featured specific exhibitions. So that also has exposed the artists and their work to a large audience.
Sasha Constable is a long-time Siem Reap resident, sculptor, and for the past 2 years, curator of the Arts Lounge.
Cambodian artists are being profiled more and more, and I mean there are particular artists that have taken off, Sapir Pick, Leng Sakon, who had a show in London last year, Rossi and Rossi, and was extremely successful. So now that some of the artists are exhibiting in other countries abroad, their work again is being exposed to another audience altogether, which means the prices go up as well, which is good for them. I mean, it's one of the last countries in this region where art has suddenly become more and more interesting to people.
Aside from the opening parties, the Arts Lounge is generally a quiet but captivating space. Every day, a range of people arrive to sip on something cool and drink in the art. They could be tourists passing through on their way to the Angkor temples, or local residents, both expat and Cambodian. Many of them have become buyers or even collectors. Yim Malin is among the beneficiaries. She's one of the artists taking part in the final exhibition at the lounge, Seven.
I think it is good for me to attend these exhibitions with other artists, and it is a good chance for next generation that they have a chance and place like this place. It gives chances to these people to show their achievement and to show the outsiders where is the art of Cambodia right now.
Sasha Constable has added some of her sculptures to the show, but she's keen to look back on her proudest moments as a curator. Top of the list, turning the sunken area of the Arts Lounge into a miniature lake.
I enjoyed Svai Soret's show because it was very different to a lot of the other work that we've exhibited. We had a huge boat on a platform in the middle of the Arts Lounge. We flooded the Arts Lounge, so it added another kind of extension to the actual exhibition.
But Seven is the final show at the Arts Lounge. Hotel de la Paix will soon be no more. Its design may be striking, idiosyncratic, and much loved, but its owners have decided they need a tie-up with a major hotel chain. A makeover will turn the de la Paix into the rather less poetic-sounding Park Hyatt Siem Reap, and the Arts Lounge will, at best, cease to exist in its current form. That'll deprive artists like Yim Malin of one of their most important outlets.
I feel so sorry because this place is such a good place and it's open for all the artists, and now it's closed. There's no more chance for other artists to show their achievement here. Yeah, it's so sad.
But while the lounge is likely to become just a lobby in the new layout, the hotel may continue to be a patron of the arts. Hyatt brought in veteran general manager Arthur Hollinger to oversee the transition, and he's been so impressed by the Arts Lounge that he wants to make sure that the new hotel doesn't abandon its roots.
Of course, a lot of people have expressed certain concerns that going from a more individualistic hotel to a big chain, whether we'll be able to maintain that sort of atmosphere. I personally believe that Park Hyatt hotels, usually wherever they operate, they very much are in tune with the local culture, the local people, the communities. And therefore, I believe we can maintain and continue this art, which I think is very important for Siem Reap.
Even those most deeply involved in the Arts Lounge are reluctant to mourn. It's just part of the country's artistic evolution, they say, and Sasha Constable thinks the Cambodian scene is now strong enough to survive the demise of the venue.
There are a number of other venues opening as we speak, almost, so I think there will be other places for artists to showcase their work, but this one has a special sort of space in everyone's minds, I think, because it was one of the first on this scale. I mean, it is a very large area and art space that we've exhibited: photography, painting, prints, installations, sculpture. And there aren't that many venues in Siem Reap that have the capacity to do that. So in that respect, it will be missed.
The buzz of the Arts Lounge may be hard to replace, but Cambodia's young artists are throwing up new ideas all the time. So what comes next may be even better. For Monocle, in Siem Reap, I'm Guy Delaunay.
You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. Up next, the man who's met more artists than I've had hot dinners.
What Cannes is to film and Venice to architecture, the city of Arles is to photography. Our Monocle film crew headed down to the south of France for the opening week of the Rencontre d'Arles, the world's leading photography festival.
Photographers love a group hug. There's a lot of talk of apertures and shutter speeds and white balance in bars and parties across town. Everyone's at it, shooting everything in sight. Everyone's got their eye on everything and how everyone else might be framing it for a shot. It's a life through a lens in Arles.
Monocle Films. Focus on photography on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bound, where we'll keep it on an art track, but one whose names are perhaps more familiar than those of the scene in Phnom Penh. Francis Bacon, Lucian Freud, Henry Moore and Frank Auerbach are a few of the names to have lit up 20th century art, and Michael Pepiat is the writer who illuminated much of their work in prose and in some wonderful interviews, published together for the first time in a new book, Interviews with Artists 1966 to 2012. I spoke to Michael about how easy it is to get words out of people who express themselves in images and who sometimes hold store by silence.
These sort of came about over a period, a long period, a good 40 years. Every now and then I was asked to go and interview somebody, or it seemed like a good idea because I'd been asked to do a preface for a show, and I took what I thought was the easy option out. I thought if I could get the artist to talk, it would be more interesting and more, it would give more direct information about the person, the art, the studio, everything connected with the artist. So very often, instead of writing a kind of eulogy in the guise of a preface, I asked the artist in question whether we couldn't do a chat.
Yeah, and these are Q&A. Most of the book is done in a Q&A
yes.
style. Is that sort of the most direct way you think of telling the truth of what you both said in that
well,
studio?
Well, because you never know when people are telling the truth. Sometimes it's quite good to ask the odd, irritating question, because that often gets under the, you know, if an artist is well known and has given a lot of interviews, you do tend to get a kind of fixed response that they've been perfecting over the years. So, yes, it's like our talking. I mean, you're interviewing me. I don't know what you're going to ask or how you're going to do it.
I have made some notes there. I can see you trying to read it. That's why I've done it in my worst handwriting.
I mean, it's a game, really, isn't it? It's a game, I think, a rather pleasant and interesting and amusing game, because you're just sort of banging ideas around like that and seeing what happens.
It's a Hadron Collider of artistic intrigue.
Yes.
That's what your book is.
Yes, I guess so. I think that's rather a grand
way of saying it. We should put that on the back.
Okay,
I'll quote you.
Yes, that sounds very good.
And there's that way. It's interesting what you say. In the introduction, you use a Hockney quote. I think you said he attributes it to Sickert, but you thought it might be his own, which is never believe what artists say, only what they do. And I suppose that's sort of about
that, I think the sort of
the artist as a performer when he talks.
Yes, yes, yes.
Did you get that with any of your with any of your subjects, do you think?
Well, you know, there is the sort of the chosen line. On the whole, I think artists are very protective of what they do, because it's their, you know, it's their universe, it's their little secret. They don't want to. It's their recipes, even. You know, it's like sort of they don't want to tell you that how they mix their paints or if they put sand in, or sometimes they do. Sometimes, but if they do that, then they're often, I think, trying to avoid a sort of deeper truth. You know, they'll be very, on the contrary, very sort of free about telling you exactly the cookery that goes into what they make. But because I think they feel that it might be too simple, it might be too straightforward, it might be too obvious. So they want to keep the mystery that they themselves feel when they're working, which is perfectly legitimate. I mean, I've always been on the side of the artist, you know, and you're lucky when you interview artists if you get them in their studio, because it's like you've got them in their context, and immediately when you go in, you look around and you see, first of all, the studio tells a great deal about the artist and how he or she works.
And I wonder that, is there a sort of balance of power in terms of the interview when you're going to their space, where they're the sort of king of their domain in their studio? Obviously, you can see, you know, if they sort of say, well, I'm a very tidy person, I work from 9 to 5, and you're interviewing them at 2 a.m, and it's a kind of hellhole. But
yeah, I think the balance of power, when I was a very young interviewer, the balance of power was always the sort of the older artist, and I was there sort of, you know, balancing my little notepad on my knee, sort of pre-recording days. And then with time, I suppose I feel less sort of in awe. I just try and get on with the person, first of all, just so that we establish a contact. And then you can't really control what happens. You know, you try and ask the intelligent question, but sometimes stupid questions give rise to more interesting answers than, you know, highly sort of developed, well-honed questions.
That's an interesting point. You're famous for a lot of your conversations, interviews with Francis Bacon, who drew on a huge amount of classical allusion and art history and a sort of critical theory sometimes in his language. But also you had very direct chats. Did you find that the best stuff came from, you know, ask a straight question, you'll get a straight answer?
The best stuff came from when, you know, you turned the recorder off and you started drinking and then went out on the town with him. That's where the best stuff came. And hopefully I managed to retain some of that and sort of work it into things like the biography of Bacon that I wrote. He also tended to have a specific stance in interviews. It's when he was relaxed and having a good time the really interesting things came out. So he wasn't the ideal person to interview. I don't know if there is an ideal person to interview, because some people talk so easily and so eloquently and you think you've got something absolutely marvellous. And then when you go back and sort of type it all out or see it in sort of in the cold light of day, it's actually rather superficial.
You realise they've said nothing.
Yes, they've been very sort of witty and this, that and the other, but they haven't really, I think they've sort of just dropped a kind of veil and haven't wanted to talk, as it were, really deeply about what they do. Perhaps they were afraid to do so, or bored, or couldn't see the point of it, or, you know, whatever. But on the whole, if they accepted to be interviewed and knew the interview was going to be published, because some of these were published in several magazines before they were included in the book. So, you know, it meant it was a sort of testimony and evidence about them and their work. So they wanted to get it as right as possible. And some artists always asked to see the interview afterwards and then started messing around with it.
Yeah, God, that's the worst.
I won't be asking you that.
I wondered what it is as a writer that attracts you to artists. Is it there is a presumably a sense, I think all writers are sort of slightly jealous of artists, that they have such a blank canvas in a way. Is this what attracted you to writing about art and to speaking to artists and then becoming friends with artists in the first place?
Well, I'd always been interested in art, and it was a way of meshing two things. I wanted to write and I was interested in art, so the two things came together. And I think there are those writers who, there always have been, particularly, say, in France over the last century. There are a lot of poets and philosophers who wrote the best things about artists like Jean Genet or Sartre on Giacometti. They remain two of the really best things ever written about Giacometti. And I'm not comparing myself to Sartre and Genet, but I think there's a natural sort of, not cohesion or collusion or...
It's an affinity between
yes,
them.
Yes, exactly. Natural affinity, so that you, as it were, they allow you onto their terrain, and if you like their art, it's a wonderful opportunity to write about it. Because, in a sense, interviews are writing, because in the editing, as you know, that's where the interview really comes together. You cut out a lot of sort of ums and ahs and sort of off-piste kind of remarks, and then try and sort of weld the whole thing together.
And that was Michael Pepiat, whose new book, Interviews with Artists 1966 to 2012, is out now. Still to come in part two, more live music from the Choir of Young Believers session, 25 years of Euro MTV celebrated by a prof, artist Antin McCall in Berlin, and an Olympic-themed minute of sound. Your dial, dear listeners, is in just the right place. If it's enlightenment thou seeketh. Stay tuned. So first up, from our Danish pals Choir of Young Believers Midori House session, this is The Third Time. Thank you. That was Choir of Young Believers with The Third Time. We're staying kind of musical now, albeit with a video theme. On the 1st of August, MTV Europe celebrated its 25th birthday. Did it change the way Europeans enjoyed music? Did it join people together in their living rooms to enjoy Johnny Hallyday videos? Did it make lots of money and change the way satellite broadcasting worked? Well, you'd want to ask a doctor of MTV those questions, wouldn't you? And that's just what I did. Lida Hujic is the world's only doctor of MTV and the author of the book The First to Know about just this subject. Here's how she and I got on.
This is quite ironic because it was an American-owned channel. It was, it still is Viacom-owned. And it became the most successful attempt to unite Europeans. It was virtual, but then, you know, it was away. And they became quite successful across Europe in terms of having loads of fans and quite successful commercially because there was MTV Europe back in the day. So between August the 1st, when it was officially launched in 1987, up to 1997, it was a pan-European channel. Mm-hmm. And that was the most successful pan-European channel that ever kind of graced the airwaves, because if we start, with the early days of satellite television, maybe should remind listeners of that.
It's a book of critical theory about MTV Europe, which is quite a rare thing. It's not really a pop culture sort of travelogue, is it? Where was your starting point? Was your starting point the business model of MTV Europe? Was it the sort of technical side of it? Or was it the pop culture side of it? Was it the emergence of bands that made amazing videos that everybody wanted to see?
I think it was a mixture of business and culture. Because what you have to bear in mind, again, is I suppose all the hip-hop and the dance culture were quite entrepreneurial. That was like Thatcher's children, they were called. You know, these was a kind of bunch of guys who were DIY cultures, but they were entrepreneurial as well. So it was very, very difficult to actually separate business from culture. I went to see Jazzy B the other day talking about their early days. And, like, you know, as much as they were doing music and breaking new boundaries with sound system, they were selling T-shirts. They were selling vintage stuff before it was vintage. So, you know, but it was a very kind of entrepreneurial DIY culture. So I think MTV became an entrepreneurial channel, and being on satellite television had to be a maverick to come up with something completely new. So I think it's very hard to disassociate the pop culture from the business model. So the two were my starting point at the same
time.
Well,
that's an interesting point. I guess the idea that a lot of the bands, especially the, you know, as you mentioned, Jazzy B, Soul to Soul, there was sort of an engineering way of getting played on the channel, because there's obviously a lot of manufactured pop on that channel as well. But that you feel that there was an entrepreneurial spirit starting off in the music business at that point.
You're very right. OK, so what I have to say also, so that people just don't go crazy listening to the airways, is I think the least documented part of MTV, which is the most interesting one, is that maverick period. So we're looking between 87 and 1993, when MTV was smaller, like your two rooms here, and you have plenty of those. They had perhaps just one room like that. There was the studio and another one that was just like waiting around. So you could just pop in, give your video VHS tape, and if it's okay, they'll call you in to make idents. Remember those visuals that MTV quite sort of pioneered, and now it's kind of television, everything is based on them. These are I'm showing with my hands. People can't,
you know what
you
mean?
See.
These were pieces of of animation. Yeah, they're pieces of sort of video art. They're pieces of
which are now called trailers. All the channels do it, self-advertising and stuff like that. But they were very, very artistic on MTV. And
so this was
same
the brand.
With music.
The brand was very important.
Absolutely, that's it. That's the core. So I think with music, rather than being American, they genuinely needed something that would appeal for a pan-European audience. So where they were genuinely looking for bands that would work. So rightly so, like, you know, French variété and French music that they try to promote heavily, other than Mano Negra and very few bands like that who got promotion on MTV and never got it on their own airwaves, worked, but a lot of stuff didn't. So MTV was very, very open-minded in those early days. And then it would start getting more corporate. I think in 93, they became profitable. They moved offices, and that's where they're still there in TVAM, and that's in London, in Camden.
And back in the day, how was European MTV different to its American daddy? I mean, was the output that much more European, or was the success of it in Europe purely because this is stuff that, because it was great videos and it was something new?
It was different. It was definitely different. And I think one of the greatest untold stories, that of Yo MTV Raps. It was a show that was invented by a French white girl. And she said, look, there's this thing happening. We should have a show. And the Americans wouldn't have it. They said, no, we don't want that. It's too risky. So the Europeans did your MTV Raps. And then the Americans ran a pilot. And it became the most successful show. And then they took it off MTV America. But it's a European show. Many European shows, even if they had the same name, like 120 Minutes, they were very different. So some stuff, of course, like grunge would cross over from America. But a lot of stuff would also just be European. I mean, like all the techno stuff, I don't think, you know, yeah. Too Unlimited and all these kinds of things that became, you know, yeah. On MTV Europe, would the cheese stuff, the Euro stuff that would never have played in America.
And we can see by the difference between MTV America and MTV Europe, perhaps the differences between those two continents written in a sort of small screen in the corner of your room, right? I mean, that's sort of, it's a microcosm, presumably, of the difference in pop culture, those two.
Indeed. But the other, I mean, stories, like the early days, the ones that we're talking about the early days of MTV Europe, by the same token, the early days of MTV America, before 85, they launched in 81, was all what they call new pop, which is new romantics, because they had no videos in America. Back in the day when America was started with their own MTV. So they thought, well, you know, we need videos. And then they started to play, you know, Culture Club and Duran Duran and all that sort of stuff. And again, cable, the operators were very, very reluctant to take on MTV in America. But then they realized that in places where they have cable, and in with MTV, the shops were starting to order the kind of music that nobody's ever heard of. So suddenly somebody is asking for Culture Club, and the rest of America says, well, what's this? So they realize that MTV could sell records. So that's kind of, and then they start to replace with their own acts. But the Europeans also gave the first videos to MTV in America.
You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. We're off to Berlin to have a look at installation artist Anthony McCall's first Berlin show after this.
Every Saturday at midday in London, join our editors on Monocle 24 for The Review. We take you on a tour of three bookshops in three cities to hear what's flying off the shelves. We listen to some top tracks with a music aficionado from a different region. And we review a stack of our favourite new magazines each week too. That's The Review, the perfect way to start your weekend, here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. For the first time, the work of the New York-based artist Anthony McCall will be presented in a solo exhibition at a German museum. McCall's unprecedented projections, which he's been developing since the 1970s, exist at the boundaries between cinema, sculpture and drawing. Melanie Shevchenko visited his exhibition at Hamburger Bahnhof, Berlin's contemporary art museum, to experience McCall's interactive cinema and speak with the exhibition's curator.
The massive exhibition space is completely dark. Projectors hang from the high ceiling and beam pure white light onto the floor, creating sculptural cones. Like buildings of light, bodies can step into these three-dimensional forms and move through them, changing their appearance.
It's strange that you could kind of enter into the shapes and the kind of the wall that was created between you once you entered into the artwork.
Bella is a young woman who lives in Dublin. On summer vacation in Berlin, she's spending an afternoon at Hamburger Bahnhof, the contemporary art museum where Anthony McCall's 5 minutes of pure sculpture is exhibiting throughout the summer.
It was like being in another world or on a different planet.
McCall's 5 minutes of pure sculpture has drawn visitors of all kinds into what the artist calls his solid light films.
What are solid light films? It's obviously a paradoxical title, but it also describes very well what these are.
Henriette Huldisch is the curator of McCall's exhibition and works primarily with media art at the Hamburger Bahnhof.
What Anthony does is he creates line animations, white on black, that are projected into a space that is filled with a very thin haze. And what happens, of course, is if you project a line of light through a room filled with particles, is that they actually start to be visible as real volumetric forms in space.
5 minutes of Pure Sculpture is a collection of work that McCall has created since 2003, though he started developing solid light films back in the 1970s. Feeling as though he had exhausted the technological possibilities of his technique, McCall took a hiatus from the art world in the late 1970s. But over two decades later, with the accessibility of digital projection and computer animation, McCall was able to compose a whole new group of work that expands his visual vocabulary.
Anthony went to art college in London and was at the beginning of his career quite active or involved with people gathered around the London Filmmakers Co-op, the cinematic avant-garde, particularly structuralist filmmakers. And you can see on the one level his interest in developing film as an art form that would be radically distinct from narrative technique and mainstream filmmaking. He's working on this interstitial area of something that is both cinema and sculptural at the same time. In film and video, Anthony's work is rather singular in that he's very specific about the fact that he works in a moving image medium, but he considers himself equally a sculptor and equally a draftsman.
As you enter into the exhibition space of 5 minutes of pure sculpture, cinema might not be the first experiential sensation that comes to mind, as McCall's veils of light evoke more of an inert, tactile aesthetic. But walk a little further inside one of the sculptures, and you'll discover the moving image component, not only from the projector mechanism itself, but through the motion of particles that are active inside the projection of light, like thin clouds drifting across a screen.
He turned the cinema on its head. He kind of reversed the regular situation. People would walk into the space, see the source of light first, then turn around and see a projective form. He always showed his films in non-cinema spaces. There was never a seating situation where people would just be sitting in front of the projection. Brandon Joseph, an art historian, has written about Anthony's works from the 70s that he democratized the projection space or the cinema space.
You kind of realize the silence as well. I think that was really important because the lack of light makes your eyes really focus on the sculpture itself.
Aoife is a friend of Bella, also visiting the exhibition from Dublin.
So then you lose what you were thinking of and instantly it becomes just about the art. Because in other spaces there's windows and everything you can look out and there's light, there's other external influences, but inside the use of light is so powerful.
People come and I think instantly respond to these works. And what I think is great is that they speak to a large group of people. People with families, kids come in and kind of intuitively access these works. And some people who come from a film or an art background also go in and kind of might appreciate the very conceptually rigorous underpinnings to a degree. And I think that's the great strength of the work.
That was Henrietta Huldisch, curator of Anthony McCall's exhibition at the Hamburger Bahnhof in Berlin, talking to Melanie Sevchenko. And you're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. Remember I said we'd only have one Olympic hit this week? Well, I lied. It's time for the ever-confusing 1 minute of sound, which this week comes from our series of very special Midori House shows we've been broadcasting from different national houses around London to celebrate the Olympics. Here's some of the weird and wonderful things we've been up to.
You're listening to Monocle 24 live from Africa Village.
Sie hören Monocle 24 vom Austriahaus Tirol.
You are listening to Monocle 24 live from Korea House. Yeah!
Well, there you go. Bizarre. And that's just about all we have time for this week. Next week, we'll be talking pop-up radio and Indian TV, among other things. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producer was Katie Bilboa, and Holly Fisher was a bloody star again. And don't forget, you can download all our Culture shows and much, much more at monocle.com via iTunes or through our mobile app. Time for one final song this week from their special Midori House session. This is the Choir of Young Believers with Hollow Talk. Thanks for tuning in.
Echoes start as they cross the room, trembling noises that come too soon. Special movements which seems to me resonating a mask of fear. Hollow talk in a hollow room. set out from a road of pain. Never said it was good, never said it was new. You didn't whisper the things you feel. Back to the beginning.